Hi, and welcome to the Well Read Podcast, a bi-weekly discussion on books and reading. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Anne.
And we are librarians with the Beaufort County Library in South Carolina. This week, we're going to be talking about books that make us cry, but in a good way. So, Anne, when we picked this topic, you, I know, said that you're going to have to think really hard about some books that made you cry.
Yeah.
So you're not much of a crier, right?
Oh, I cry all the dang time. So I just don't cry at books. So I feel like everything makes me cry, but probably things that are designed to make me cry never make me cry.
Okay.
So my biggest thing with tearjerkers is I feel manipulated by them.
Uh-huh.
And this, I think, happens more in movies and TV than with books. But especially in movies, I always feel like if it's something that is set up to be a tearjerker, it just makes me want to cross my arms and kind of sulk because I'm not going to go for that. But the thing is it still makes me cry, but I'm mad that I'm crying because I don't actually feel like I care about these characters generally, but then I still am crying because there's music and there's all these things that are kind of designed to be these trigger points, and it somehow makes me really angry. So.
That's why, because I'm sort of the opposite. I don't cry much in real life, but I'll cry at TV and movies and books more than real situations.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of. Like, I'm more stoic in real life, but then if you give me a book that's moving in any way, I'm crying immediately.
Yeah. Like, what would qualify as a tearjerker for you in a book?
Generally, in a book, something that's a tearjerker is anything that touches me. It can be happy or sad, or generally if it's sad, if there's death involved, if there's illness involved, that's probably gonna make me cry. But sometimes it's a happy thing because it's hard won, you're hard fought, it's taken a while to get there. Those can make me well up a little bit because I think I'm so touched by it. But generally, I would say I'm more of a crier for sad things.
Right.
The happy things just make me happy. They're not always going to make me cry happy tears.
Right.
What about you?
I think if it's something that I've dealt with personally, it will usually make me cry just because I'm more thinking of the real life situation versus the book itself, but it touches on something that I recognize. So that makes me cry. I think hopeless situations will make me cry a lot. Then also happy endings where it seems like it is impossible, but then it gets there and you're just so relieved that they got there that I will cry at that. I'm trying to think of other things.
Well, you think I just thought of two things. Anything to do with children and animals.
Oh,
will
yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, I think I don't like that feeling, so I tend to avoid those books. So I don't have a lot of things to draw on when we talk about tearjerkers, because I know that if there's a book where a dog dies at the end, I just
don't
want to do it.
Yeah.
So
sometimes I don't know that I seek out books that make me cry generally, but there are times where it does feel good to cry, and I'm not sure why. It's cathartic in a way. To read something that makes you feel that much.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely a testament to the author's ability that you care about something so much that it brings out those sorts of emotions just through the written word, I think.
Right.
So I don't necessarily try, it's not like if I'm in a certain mood I want a sad book, it's just it strikes me in that way at that moment, and that makes me cry for some reason.
Yeah. Well, I think that for me, kind of going along those same lines, it's when I find something that sort of touches on the bigger picture moments where you suddenly realize, like, maybe something involving the feelings for your family or friends or your loved ones, that you suddenly have this idea of everything is sort of bigger than just yourself.
Uh-huh.
Those will usually make me cry.
Yes.
And that's what makes me cry in real life, too.
Yes.
So then I think, this is honest, this is real crying instead of this feeling like I've been talked into it somehow. So.
Yes, I agree. There's a book, I won't name any names, but there was a book that I read back when I was in grad school that I loved it until the end, and then the end, and I was sobbing at the end, but it felt so emotionally manipulative that it was kind of a big twist at the end, just purposely to make you sad.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, wait, I don't know if this is earned, but yet I'm still sobbing
still
like a baby.
Right. Yeah, that's what frustrates me. I want to feel like it's something that I legitimately feel versus just that the author hit all the right notes. So
all right, well, if you are in the mood for a book that will make you cry, Anne and I have some suggestions for you. And just to prepare you, we are going to have an episode on books that make you laugh. So we're not all about the sad things, but this week we're going to be all about books that can make you cry.
Yes.
Anne, what is your first suggestion?
So the first book I picked is one that came out either last year or the year before. I think the year before, actually. And it's a YA book, and it's called Far, Far Away by Tom McNeil. It was hard for me to get my hands on it because it's actually a South Carolina award winner for this year for the summer reading. So I'm glad that it's getting some attention because I don't think it got a lot of attention otherwise. And it's about a boy named Jeremy Johnson Johnson, and he has that name because his parents both have the same last name of Johnson. And he lives in the town of Never Better, and he hears the voice of the ghost of Jakob Grimm, of the Brothers Grimm, and this ghost watches over him. So it already is set up for this really intriguing fantasy world that has kind of tinges of darkness in it. So it's very much like a fairy tale. And the ghost of Jakob Grimm protects Jeremy from this vague evil that's mentioned, and it kind of goes through these interspersing chapters, and you sort of figure out what's going on as the story goes along. And this evil is called the Finder of Occasions, and he occupies the space between this world and the next, and as the book goes on, he becomes more solidified and more details are given about him until you kind of figure out exactly what's going on. But because Jeremy can hear these voices, he's ostracized from the people in his town. And he sort of lives this outsider lifestyle, but there's a girl named Ginger that becomes fascinated by him, and they develop a friendship and a relationship. Through her, then Jeremy is introduced to all this trouble that he would never have known about without having met this girl. And Jakob is trying to prevent this through his protective voice over Jeremy. And so I really can't give any more details about what happens in the book, because everything that goes on from there is unexpected. And it goes to these places like a fairy tale where things start out light and beautiful, and then they kind of go to these really dark, haunting places that I love as a reader. So that's my favorite to read about. But there are, just like in a fairy tale, you have your adventure moments, you have horror moments, but you also have the writing style in this book is kind of this antiquated fairy tale style, which I really like. I think it's really fun to read that way. And there's all these allusions to Grimm fairy tales, and it kind of feels like reading The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
It sort of has that same tone, I think, to it. I think of this as a tearjerker. I actually went through all my reviews that I've written, and this one I wrote profusely about how much I cried at the end of this book. And so I won't tell anything about the plot, but the relationship between Jeremy and Jakob is really poignant, and it's kind of hard to explain what the relationship is, because they're not really friends. It's not a father-son relationship. It's not a brother relationship. It's, I guess, like a guardian angel was kind of the best way that you could describe it. The protectiveness that Jakob has over Jeremy is just really, really sweet and really beautiful. And I cried like an idiot at the end of this book. If you want something that's kind of just a very sweet story but a good reward for having gone through a lot of kind of terrifying places, then I really, really recommend Far, Far Away.
All right, it sounds really good. I love any sort of fairy tale retellings or newer versions of fairy tales. So that sounds fantastic. All right, so my first one of this week's episode that I would recommend is actually my favorite book that I've read so far this year.
Ooh.
And I'm so excited to talk about it because I just can't, I'm bursting at the seams to recommend it. It's called The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna.
Oh, yeah.
I talked last week about how much I like World War II fiction, and this one, it takes place in World War II in France, so that's sort of a different perspective on a lot of the World War II fiction that I've read, which mostly takes place in Germany,
mm-hmm.
or England, I guess, but
yeah.
Generally not in France. And it explores how war affects everyone, not just those who are fighting. This is about two French sisters, Vianne and Isabelle. And their mother died when they were young, and their father has raised them, but he's very distant. So the two of them take different paths because of that. Vianne marries her high school sweetheart very young at the age of 16, and they have a daughter together, and they live in the French countryside in kind of a calm, peaceful, quiet village. And then Isabelle is the younger sister, and she's very adventurous, and she has been bounced around from different boarding schools because her father wasn't interested in taking care of her, and she has gotten in a lot of trouble in each school, and so she keeps getting moved and kicked out. And she ends up in Paris, and her father sends her to the countryside to be with her sister. She basically runs away from where her sister lives. She doesn't want to live in this small town. So Vianne's husband is conscripted into the army, and he goes off to fight, and she's left alone to take care of her daughter. And Germans invade the town and take over, and they are forced to take a German soldier into their home. So that's Vianne in this small town trying to make do, and with a lack of supplies as the war goes on, their food supplies dwindle and they can't get clothing, and it gets cold, there's no heat in their houses and all these things. At the same time, dealing with the fact that these Germans have invaded their town. And meanwhile, Isabel joins the resistance and she starts risking her life in order to transport fallen British and American airmen over the Pyrenees into Spain so that they can be free and they won't be captured as prisoners of war by the Germans. So she has sort of the more flashy story in that there's definitely more risk. But the quiet story of Vianne dealing with what's happening in her small town is very powerful too, because it's more on a personal level. It's at least smaller things that are happening to her. Her neighbors are Jewish, and so it's about the fact that she has good friends who their future is uncertain, and then she's having to deal with these people in their town and taking over. So these two stories are both equally engrossing, and even though the sisters are very different, they care about each other very much, and you do understand that they're sisters. There are similarities there. They each are taking risks in their own way. The only way I can describe this book is just completely engrossing. It was, from the very first page that I started reading, it was a day that I was trying to decide what to read, and so often when I do that, I pick three or four books and read the first few pages and decide what's going to get my attention. And this one, I read the first page and I never even looked at the other books. I just continued on reading this. It's completely heartbreaking because it shows the courage and endurance these women have and the resilience that they possess, but what that does to them and how hard it is for them, and in sort of a way that they don't advertise everything that they're doing. They just get on with their lives and do it and make a difference, but they're not being loud about it. And this one made me cry multiple times throughout the book for various reasons, but it's a book that I felt like when I finished it, I missed the characters. They had become so much a part of me in the course of reading it that I felt like they were such real people that I knew and cared about. This is an example of where I just cared about what happened to them so much and them as people. And so when I finished the book, I was sad because of the events in the book, but I was just sad that the reading experience was over because I enjoyed it so, so much. Like I said, it was one of the best books that I read this year, and I thought it was a different take on World War II than what I'd read before, and I appreciated her writing style. It's very fluid. The way she writes just brings you, like I said, the first page brings you right into the story, and you learn about these women and their lives throughout the course of the war, and it's just completely moving and powerful.
It's getting lots and lots of attention,
yes.
too.
Yes.
So it's, I feel like every third book that's requested at the library, at my branch at least, is The Nightingale.
Yeah.
So.
And everybody I've recommended it to has completely loved it. So this is one I feel very confident in saying it's just a wonderful read no matter who you are. I haven't seen anybody that has disliked it so far. There's something for everybody in there because there's the more adventure story of Isabel with these airmen and trying to get over the mountains, and it's so hard. And then Vianne's story, which is more the daily life of what's going on for people being affected by the war. There's the history, but there's the women's lives aspect to it.
Right.
So it's really, really good. This is the one that I would push in everybody's hands. Like, I'm generally more of a person that I want to find out exactly what kind of book you like or what authors that you prefer, the typical librarian who wants to match the perfect book with the reader.
Right.
And this is one that I just blanket give out to everybody. This is when somebody says, have you read a good book right recently?
Yeah.
This is the book that I give them because I just loved it so much and think that it's an important story to be told, and it will make you cry most likely, but it's worth it. It's worth the sadness to read this beautiful story of these sisters and these women and what they go through.
There are a few books that have come out this year that I've heard such good things about, and I just haven't gotten to them yet, but that's really high on my list.
Yeah.
It sounds really, really amazing. Okay, so my next tearjerker is, I know, one of your favorite books, so thanks for letting me talk about it, because I have so few to pick from. Mine is, the one I picked is Me Before You by JoJo Moyes. This has been out for 3 or 4 years, maybe just 2 years?
Two or three, I think. Yes.
It's fairly recent.
Yeah.
So it's easy to get your hands on. The book centers around, the main character is a young woman named Lou Clark, and she is living in a small English town. This is her hometown, and she lives with her family, and she has a boyfriend, but her life isn't all that exciting. She's just working in a tea shop, and she's sort of just going day to day. And then she loses her job in the tea shop, and she's hired to be a caretaker to a man named Will Traynor, who used to be a rich kind of bad boy. He was a wealthy executive, and he would do all kinds of thrill-seeking activities and ride motorcycles and go skydiving and things like that. But he gets into an accident, and so he becomes a quadriplegic. So Will has completely lost his desire to live, and he has decided to go through with an assisted suicide. He wants to do this immediately, but his parents talk him into waiting for 6 months to do this, to go through with this. And during that time, they hire Will, hire Lou to take care of him. So Lou decides that while she's working for him, then she's going to show him that life is worth living and that he doesn't have to go through with this, and hopefully she can change his mind. But their first few encounters are just so terrible. They're so bad. And so it's sort of a typical romance setup where they don't get along at first and then they start to get along. But there's something very sweet and authentic about how this all comes about that, for me, who has a cold, dead heart, I still found it
very
moving.
You're a robot.
I am a robot. I always talk about my cold, dead vortex of a heart. The book is less about just her trying to fix him. They're really trying to fix each other, because just as Lou is trying to convince Will that there are reasons to live, then Will is trying to show Lou that there's more to life than just this very small contained existence that she has in this town. And she just hasn't really given herself the credit to think that she can do anything besides live in this small town and just never move on from there. So it's really a book about two people that are trying to change each other in the best ways, but they are dealing with this tragic reality that Will isn't going to get better. This isn't something where there can be a miracle cure that something will be figured out. This is a spinal injury. It's a permanent spinal injury. So there isn't really a hopeful situation that can come out of this. The setup, if I just were to read this setup on the back of the book, I probably wouldn't pick it up, because I would feel like it's meant to be a tearjerker, and it is. It's definitely geared toward that. But the author, I think, fleshes things out in such an authentic way and gives these characters really... There's something about the backstories to these characters that feels really real to me, instead of them just being kind of two misfits that meet up with each other, then they have really plausible reasons for being the way they are, which I appreciated, because I feel like, and I think I've mentioned this, that it drives me nuts when there's just sort of a quirky girl that's the heroine that is sort of a construct of the man's desires, and this isn't that type of book. She's really authentic. So I thought the writing was really thoughtful. I thought that the choices that she makes are really well thought through, and she doesn't just put things in for the sake of making them or making a reader cry. She thinks through all of the possibilities and all of the kind of the emotions and feelings that would go along with these kinds of decisions. And I, as a reader, really appreciate that kind of thing. I think that when, as someone who doesn't read a lot of romances, then it's nice to find something that has a romantic tinge to it that feels like there's kind of more weighty issues that are going on with it. So I stayed up all night to read this, which I talked about last week, but it happens periodically. And I cried at several points in this book. And it's heartwarming in the best ways. It's tragic. It's romantic. It's kind of a book you want to hug when you're finished with it. So, and there's a surprise sequel that was just announced out of nowhere.
So exciting.
That's coming out in September. And I think that the author didn't intend this book to be a sequel at all, or to have a sequel. But she said, from what I read, that people have asked her so many questions about these characters that her mind was continually on them even after she had finished the book, and so she ended up coming up with another story. So that comes out in September. We're both really, really excited.
Yes,
about it.
I'm so excited. I love this book. Like I said about The Nightingale, this was the book a few years ago that I just recommended to everybody because I thought that anybody could get something out of it.
Well, I think that's why I read it, because you were pushing it so hard.
I'm a book pusher. Pure pressure. Don't force people to drink or do drugs. I force them to read books. And I think that I agree with you. She does a great job of making it feel very real. The characters feel genuine and their actions feel realistic.
Yeah. Well, it feels like what you were saying with being really invested in the characters and actually caring about them.
Yes.
And so by the time it's finished, you sort of close it and you think, wait, no, there's, I need more.
You want more
about
their lives.
We're getting it.
I know. So say the title again. I realized we didn't do that before.
It's Me Before You by JoJo Moyes.
Okay. right, my next one is Forever Interrupted by Taylor Jenkins Reid. And it's not really your typical love story, nor is it your typical sad book, because the sad part happens within the first few pages of the book. And I hadn't read a description of it. This was a book that I must have seen online somewhere on Goodreads or a review of it that intrigued me. So it was when I put it on hold at the library. And then when it came in, I just started reading it without remembering what about it made me think I wanted to read it. So I was completely taken by surprise, but I'm not giving any spoilers because the event that I'm about to describe takes place at the very beginning. It's about a couple, and 9 days after they get married, the husband in the couple dies tragically in an accident when he's riding his bike and he's hit by a truck.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So the next day, Elsie, the wife, meets her husband's mother. It's the first time they've ever met, and her mother has never even heard of Elsie.
Oh, wow.
And it starts coming out that the romance between Elsie and Ben was a whirlwind romance. They met one day, and he pursued her, and they fell in love, and they eloped, and it all happened very quickly. And the book goes back and forth between chronicling their romance and how they fall in love, and then to the aftermath of his death and how Elsie is grieving and her interactions with his mother and the other people in his life, because their romance happened so quickly, she never knew those people. She never got to know those people. And there are reasons that Ben has of why he never told his mother about her, and they're believable, but there doesn't make it easier on her to understand why he never told her mother. So their relationship from the get-go has a lot to overcome, because his mother feels like Elsie doesn't necessarily have the right to grieve him as much as his mother does, because she didn't know him for very long. And what the author does really well is by showing him their relationship as it plays out after you know what ultimately happens, it's so bittersweet, because it's this charming, charming romance. And you see how they fell in love, even though on paper it seems sort of unbelievable that they would fall in love and get married so quickly, and that he wouldn't, other people in his life might not know about her. She makes it so that you understand why that happened. As you're seeing the romance as it plays out, but you know that he doesn't live past the beginning of their marriage, it's very bittersweet, because it's such a sweet love story, but you know the ultimate outcome is sad, but you're seeing that they got that joy and that love in their lives for that short period of time, and that's worth something, even if it didn't last for as long as they expected it to last. And as the year goes on after Ben has died, Elsie and his mom start getting to know each other better and start helping each other grieve. And they come to understand each other's perspectives, and the love that they both had for Ben helps bring them together, even though at first they have kind of a contentious relationship. And they help each other heal and share the things that they knew about him that the other maybe didn't have the access to because of their relationship with him. And so obviously it's an extremely emotional book, but it's also hopeful because you see the events after he has died that make it so that they're going to be okay without him, but it's still sad.
Yeah.
It's still very sad. I mean, but yet it's not emotionally manipulative, I didn't feel like. I thought that it all came from a really honest place. That's Forever Interrupted by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Okay, so my next book is a classic, and I picked Persuasion by Jane Austen. It makes me cry so much every time I read it, and I love it so much. So this is, I guess, what I go to when I feel like I need a good cry. I'm always surprised when I talk about this book, though, to people that they aren't more familiar with Persuasion. Everyone obviously knows Jane Austen. She's a household name, but for some reason this book seems to get overlooked a little bit more than some of her flashier books, I think. So this takes place in Regency England, and it was published originally after Jane Austen's death. It was the last book that she wrote, and it was published in 1818. And the main character is named Anne Elliot, and she is 27, so at this time she's considered an old maid. She's living with her father and her sister, and before the book starts, then, we're given this information that Anne was proposed to years before by a naval officer named Frederick Wentworth. And he was a really good man. He was very good to her, but he didn't have any kind of family connections or wealth, so her family persuades her to not marry him and to reject the proposal. Her family is wealthy, and they have high status, and they think that she can do better than him. So in the years in between, when this proposal happens, and when the book starts, I think it's been 8 years since then, and Anne hasn't met anyone else, and the book opens with the Elliot family on the verge of financial ruin. And this is entirely due to her father's extravagant lifestyle. So Anne is kind of the only really level-headed member of this family. And so she convinces her father and sister that she's living with that they should move to the city of Bath in England and leave the family estate to be rented out by someone else. And so they're going to kind of live in an apartment, and they'll still have this kind of fashionable lifestyle that they're used to in Bath, but it won't be quite as much of an expense. So once they rent the estate, then it turns out that the family that rents it is the wife of the family is Wentworth's sister. So they're put into the same social circle that they had once been in 8 years prior. Suddenly they're meeting up again. And at this point, Wentworth has become this captain, and he's a hero of the Napoleonic Wars, and he's rich and he's well respected, and he's considered this extremely eligible bachelor. When they're meeting up, then he's always around these other girls, and there are all these young women that are kind of fascinated by him and want to hear his war stories, and he's flirting with them because he's rich and he can, and he's looking for a wife. And he's polite to Anne, but he calls her much changed when he talks about her, so that she feels like it's sort of an insult to her, and he seems really indifferent to her, and all of this is really hurtful to Anne, and she feels like this is kind of her punishment for having rejected him. So there are tons of other things that happen in this book. There are all kinds of developments that take place. But it's a Jane Austen book, so there's obviously things that are going to make you squeal and be giddy by the end of the book. But I find it to be a really bittersweet book, even though there's going to be a happy ending. I'm not giving anything away if you know Jane Austen at all. The way it gets there is really bittersweet, and there's the sadness that kind of covers the whole book. It's that sadness that you get when you see a moment having passed you by, or see someone that you love moving on with someone else, being haunted by the decisions that you made that you think were probably the wrong decision. And I think that's something that most people can relate to at some point in their lives. So there's a line in the book that it just gets me every time I read this book or when I watch the movie, which is an incredibly good movie. The 1995 movie that the BBC put out is just so amazing. And the scene in particular is really great in the movie. So Anne is talking to a friend of Captain Wentworth, and they're just having a discussion about how men and women behave in relationships. And this man says that in romantic relationships, then the love of a man is stronger than that of the woman, that he is more committed to the relationship. And Anne gives this line where she says, "All the privilege I claim for my own sex is that of loving longest when existence or when hope is gone." And it's just the saddest, that line gets me.
Oh, my heart.
So that to me, and that's a really critical line that she says. There are developments from that line that are really important to the story. So that's kind of pivotal in the end of the book. So this is by far my favorite Jane Austen. I love all Jane Austen, but this is my absolute favorite. And the thing that's really funny to me is that I read it when I was 16 and I already completely identified
with
it, which is strange because I had zero dating experience at that point. But I just thought, I'm going to be Anne Elliot someday. So poor little 16-year-old Anne just was convinced of her spinsterhood, which is hilarious to me. But as I've gotten older, then this book has kind of resonated even more with me. I sort of understood those feelings as a teenager, but I have had a lot more relationship experience since then. There's so many things in this book that are applicable to someone that has gone through a heartbreak. But it doesn't end that way. There's all this hope in this book that kind of make it beyond the... It could be a really, really sad, depressing book, but there's Jane Austen isn't in the business of leaving you sad and depressed.
Right.
She's there to give you hope. So it's one of my absolute favorite books of all time.
I love Jane Austen.
Yeah.
Every book this week is just I love. I like this topic. So my last one is Wonder by R.J. Palacio. I think that's how you spell it.
Yeah, I've heard such good things about this.
This is so good. And this is not a sad one. This isn't a tearjerker because it's sad. This is one that's touching, I would say, over being sad. It's about a young boy named Augie Pullman, and he was born with severe facial deformities because he has this rare genetic disorder. And he is 10 years old, and he's had 27 different surgeries to try to correct these things. But even still, he calls his face like a big mush of a face. In the book it opens, he talks about his face and he says, no matter what you're thinking, it's worse than that.
Wow.
And he's been homeschooled all of his life, partially because he had to go through all of these surgeries and the recovery wouldn't have allowed him to miss that much school, partially because his parents were trying to protect him from people making assumptions about who he was based on what he looked like. And he has decided at 10 years old that he's ready to attend a regular school. So for the first time, he's going to start fifth grade, which is middle school. Middle school can be hard for any child. I always say middle school is like the worst time for everybody because everybody's figuring out who they are, who they're going to be friends with. And I just think that's an awful time. But it's a particularly difficult time for any child who's different in any way. All you want to do is fit in.
Right.
I think when you're around that age, between 10 and 13, for him, he has no hope of ever fitting in because he looks so different. And so you should see his journey through the school year, both from his perspective and then from other people that surround him, other kids in his school, his sister, his parents. So you're seeing how that decision that he makes to go to school affects multiple people, not just him. And it really shows with a great deal of insight, I feel like, what it feels to be singled out for something that you have no control over. This isn't any sort of action that he's taken that has made people think of him a certain way. It's not his personality that people are judging him. It's not anything that he has any control over. And how he deals with that and how he handles all of those preconceptions is very admirable for anybody, but let alone a 10-year-old child. You just so root for Augie. You just want the best for him. And although this is technically a middle grade book, so that would be for like fourth, fifth, sixth graders, I feel like everybody should read this book because it gives such a good example about judging people based on their appearance or based on just a little bit of information that you know about them versus them as a complete person. If you have any children in your life, I would say read it together with the child or read it to the child or have them read it and you read it and discuss it, because there's a lot to be said about what people assume about other people that might not necessarily be true. And it has this great triumphant ending that you just are so happy at the end and so hopeful, and it makes you feel good about humanity. And this is one where I was crying the happy tears because it's just such justice that you feel like you've been through all of this with Augie and he is such a good kid. And you feel for him so much that he has to go through all of these things. And it's definitely a recommendation I would make. No matter what your age is, you will appreciate Augie and his story in this book. And that's Wonder by R.J. Palacio.
That sounds great. I own that book, but I haven't read
it
yet. But I think everyone that I've talked to that's read it says it's just one of the greatest books.
Yeah, it's so powerful.
Yeah.
And I don't read much of that age range. We talked last week about YA, and I read a ton of that, but younger than YA, I don't read much of, and I was pleasantly surprised at how much depth there was to this story. It's written at a level that a fourth grader could understand it, but the emotions behind it, anybody, it's universally applicable. Anybody can appreciate the emotions that go along with this, and the feeling of being an outsider. I think everybody's been there before, that you feel like an outsider, you feel uncertain about your place, and everybody will appreciate it. So that wraps up our section on tearjerkers. Anne, what are you reading this week?
I needed something that was completely different from the tearjerkers that we've been talking about. So for my book club, I run a mystery book club at my branch, and this month we are talking about cozy mysteries, and that is something that is a huge section of the mystery genre. There are just a billion of these paperback cozy mysteries that are typically based on, you don't know what a cozy is, it's a mystery that's usually solved by an amateur detective. There's kind of a small group of suspects, and it isn't like, you're not going to find conspiracy theories in these types of books. And there's very little sex or violence. The murder usually happens off the page or screen. it's usually something that's bloodless. It's kind of mystery light in a way. And so there's this trend in the past 10 years of doing these mysteries that are kind of focused around either culinary themes or a hobby or something along those lines. And I think that these are, especially culinary mysteries, these are my catnip. They're, to me, candy in book form. And if I could just sit on a beach and read these all day, that would be my favorite activity, because they're just so... wow, they're so much fun. But there's not a lot you can talk about in terms of a book club. You can't have a deep discussion on one of these. So we all read a different book and then just talked about what we read. So the book I picked for my book club was called Final Sentence by Daryl Wood Gerber. And this is a culinary mystery. It's the first in the series called The Cookbook Nook. mysteries.
That's so cute.
Yes, and there's a cat on the cover, because all of these books have some sort of animal on the cover. So the book centers around Jenna Hart, and she is an ad executive from San Francisco, and she's in her late 20s. And she moves back to her hometown of Crystal Cove, California, after her husband dies in a boating accident. And there's kind of mysterious circumstances around this, which doesn't really get focused on in the book other than her grieving process. So she's offered the opportunity by her aunt Vera to go back to her hometown and help her open this cookbook store called the Cookbook Nook. And so she accepts this. As part of their opening, they decide to ask Jenna's former college roommate, who has become a famous chef, to come to this opening. And the roommate's name is Desiree Devine.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, that's the type of name you find in this kind of book. So she agrees to come to the opening, and after she arrives, they see each other, and they're all excited to see each other after several years. And she goes off to kind of get ready for the appearance, and one of the members of the entourage that comes with Desiree says to Jenna that she's surprised that she would book her when Desiree had an affair with Jenna's husband. And so this is news to Jenna. She doesn't know any of this information. And so she spends her entire evening trying to track down Desiree because she needs answers to this. And so she doesn't find her, and she goes home, and the next morning she gets up to go walk on the beach just to clear her head and kind of figure out what she's going to do that day to when she sees Desiree. But of course she finds Desiree's body on the beach. Yes.
Intriguing.
Yes. So Jenna is suspected instantly because the rumor mill had kind of started to talk about the possibility this affair had happened. So Jenna starts to investigate the crime just to clear her own name and also to try to get some answers about this potential affair. That's the basic plot, and then the rest of it is her just finding out what happens. These mysteries, if you're looking for a mystery that won't make you sort of shake your fist at how people react unrealistically, this is not it, because the characters make me crazy in these books. They do things that I think no one would ever behave this way, and everyone is super, super over the top, because that's sort of the tradition of these mysteries, that you have to have these really eccentric characters, and it's full of townspeople that each have their own tiny local business that sort of makes you want to exist in these small towns. But you hear about what people are cooking, you hear about all these crazy characters, you see people in these really unrealistic scenarios, but that's the fun of it. Mm-hmm. And so even more kind of campy in this book, the author references her own books that she writes in another series.
Oh.
So she's constantly saying, I picked up this book about a cheese shop in Ohio, and this looked really fun. So that one she actually writes under the name of Avery Ames. That's
her
other series.
That.
Yeah. They're very light, they're very fluffy, they're perfect for summer. If you like mysteries, if you like food, then these are great books to pick up. So I needed kind of an opposite from what we were reading of the tearjerkers. This is perfect for that. So
I love those amateur mysteries, because nothing ever too terrible happens.
Yeah.
Murder is kind of glossed over. It's never, the people that are murdered are typically not gruesome in any way.
Yeah, and you didn't get to know them.
You don't
get
to know them, so you don't feel any big loss that
right.
they're not there. It's just more the plot device to have the investigation go on.
Right.
I really enjoy that.
And the investigation is really just there to show the town.
Right.
So
there's
something
about display the characters in the town.
So
yeah.
I could read these all day. They're so fun.
That's fun. All right, so I'm stretching the definition a little bit of what we're reading this week, because I actually read this book a while ago, but it comes out the Tuesday after this episode will be posted. So I thought this was a good time to talk about it, because if I talked about it a couple of months ago, it wouldn't have much relevance to people. It is Circling the Sun by Paula McLean. And Paula McLean is the same woman who wrote The Paris Wife, which came out a few years ago about Ernest Hemingway's first wife, Hadley. It was a big bestseller, particularly among book clubs. That was a fantastic story in its own right. This one is about Beryl Markham. It's a fictionalized account of her life. She was the first woman pilot to cross the Atlantic solo from east to west, I believe.
Yes.
And that was in 1932. And this book focuses on her life from her childhood leading up to the flight. So it's not about the flight, it's what got her to the point where she took that flight. And her father was a horse trainer, and her mother is out of the picture. I can't remember, I believe her mother died when she was young, but she's definitely not in the picture. So her father's raising her, but he sort of lets her run wild, and they're living in Africa, and she has the opportunity to be this fearless, free-spirited child. She grows into a strong-willed woman, And she refuses to be defined by the typical society norms of what a woman is or what a woman could do. And she becomes a horse trainer and a breeder, which is not something that any other woman has done. And she's very, very good at her job. But you see how people assume that because she's a woman, she maybe doesn't know what she's doing. Or even if they recognize how good she is at her job, they don't value her the way they would a man who was doing that job, but it doesn't stop her from forging her own path based on what she is interested in and what she is good at. She has a couple of relationships throughout the book, a couple of failed marriages that she has, and one of the longest lasting relationships is not her marriage, it is a relationship with Dennis Finch Hatton, who is a big game hunter in Africa, and he was involved in a relationship with Karen Blixen, who is the author
yes.
of Out of Africa. And they have this love triangle between the three of them, between Beryl Markham and Karen Blixen and then Dennis Finch Hatton. And the way MacLean portrays the lifestyle of these people at the time, it's a very insulated community of these expats that live there. It's sort of a freewheeling kind of a lifestyle. They drink a lot. Affairs are just commonplace. Nobody thinks twice about the fact that their husband is sleeping with somebody else or their wife is in love with somebody else. And it's all out in the open, but there's a lot of gossip as well because it's such a small community that they all talk about each other constantly. And if somebody makes a mistake, they can be ostracized from the community. There's lots of partying that goes on. It can be very glamorous to read about and to hear about those stories. But then at the same time, their life is very hard because they're living in Africa and the terrain is not very forgiving and they have to deal with things that the people where they've come from, most of them are English or from other European countries, and the lives that they led before they came to Africa were very different. So it's hard on a lot of them to live there, but they still choose to live there for various reasons. Beryl is a very complicated woman, but she's fascinating to read about. The decisions she makes are so opposite of what choices many women were making at the time, and she really does just make her own path through life, and it's a very atmospheric to read about Africa. It's like sensuous. It's all hot. The way she describes the animals and the lifestyle there is fascinating to read about. But then Beryl in her own right, I could have read 400 more pages about this woman. She just completely captured my attention. She's so adventurous. In fact, I was expecting there to be more about her flight, but it does end right as her flight is beginning. And so I wish that there would be a sequel that follows her life from 1932 on, because I think she was born in 1902, and I think she lived until she was in her 80s. So there's a lot more life to talk about, but
yeah.
Paul MacLean just focused on this aspect of her life. Anyway, that's Circling the Sun by Paula MacLean. It comes out Tuesday, the 28th of July, and I would suggest anybody who is interested in historical fiction read it. This is like your culinary mysteries are catnip for you.
Mm-hmm.
Historical fiction based on real people is catnip for me. I cannot get enough of that. Every book that I've read about a real person, I've enjoyed very much, and this is no exception. And this actually was even better than a lot of what I have read. I think that Paula MacLean does an excellent job of taking facts and turning them into a story that is... this book made me want to go and read Beryl Markham's biography, which I think is a hallmark of historical fiction authors, that they want you to be interested in the time or the person or the place and go and read more about it. And that's how I felt. I wanted to read Karen Blixen's book, Out of Africa. I wanted to learn more about Dennis Finch Hatton. I wanted to learn more about Beryl Markham.
I think this is going to be a huge, huge book.
I agree.
And I'm really excited because Karen Blixen, or exactly. Dennis is what is her writing. She's my favorite writer.
Oh, is she?
Yeah. So I read, she writes a lot of, she wrote Out of Africa as a memoir, but then she's written all these short stories
mm-hmm.
that are kind of what she considered her trademark. So I read Beryl Markham's memoir, West with the Night,
mm-hmm.
kind of thinking, I'm going to see what this woman is all about.
It was on the opposite
yeah.
side of the love triangle.
And it's a gorgeous book.
Yeah.
It's so beautifully written
mm-hmm.
and so evocative. And I adored that book. So I think that we're going to have a lot of people interested in both
yes.
that. And when this book comes out, they'll want to go back and read what she had to say about
yes.
her own life.
All right, should we go over all the books that we talked about
yes.
today? All right, give me your list.
Okay, so I read Far, Far Away from Tom McNeill, Me Before You by Jojo Moyes, Persuasion by Jane Austen, and then what I read this week was Final Sentence by Daryl Woodgerver.
And I talked about The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna, Forever Interrupted by Taylor Jenkins Reid, Wonder by R.J. Palacio, and then what I sort of read this week, but what I want you to read this week is Circling the Sun by Paula MacLean. If you want to get in touch with us to give us feedback or a suggestion on a topic you'd like us to discuss, you can email us at wellreadpod@gmail.com or on Twitter at wellreadpodcast. Please rate and review us on iTunes or your other podcast provider. Our theme music is Kitten by Poddington Bear. We keep our show notes at beaufortcountylibrary.org/wellread, and you can find a listing of every book we talked about in this episode there. Thank you all for listening, and happy reading!